secrets, and it's not getting things done is not really about getting things done. It's about being appropriately engaged with your life.
How do I define leadership?
Confidence without ego.
I never expected things to happen if you didn't work every single day at them.
Hi, podcast listeners. I'm Lillian Cunningham, the editor of On Leadership at The Washington Post. Each week, we talk to influential people about their lives and careers and the lessons they learned along the way. This week, we're doing something a little different with the podcast. Jenna McGregor is a writer for the On Leadership section here at The Post, and she recently interviewed productivity guru David Allen. 15 years ago, he wrote a best-selling book called Getting Things Done, which he refers to as GTD, and the book has stayed wildly popular ever since then. So he recently rewrote an updated edition of the book this year. We decided it would be great to share their conversation with the podcast listeners here. The only thing is that audio quality is not so great. Normally, we record these interviews in our studio at the Washington Post, but David Allen lives in Amsterdam and Jenna McGregor lives in North Carolina. So their conversation was on the phone, and you can definitely tell in the quality of the audio recording. The conversation is really interesting, though, so we figured, you know what, we'll put it out here, we'll share it with you anyway. For our next podcast, we'll return back to the studio quality, but for those of you who are interested in David Allen and some of his tips on cutting back on email and clearing your head and making your time more productive, here's their conversation, and we hope you enjoy it. Here goes.
Maybe before we go any further, it would be helpful, you know, for the uninitiated, how would you summarize the GTD system?
Well, a key element of it is the five-step process for how you get things under control, whether that's your kitchen or your head or your company, it doesn't matter. You actually go through five stages. And the first stage, which we now identify as capture, means I need to identify the things that are not on cruise control. What's on my mind? What's bugging me? What's nagging at me? What's incomplete? What's something that might pop into my head at 3 o'clock in the morning? Now, everybody has made lists, but you need to then move it to the next, you know, the next few stages. Once you identify this stuff, like mom, you write down mom because her birthday's coming, or you write down bank because you need to extend your credit line or something, but you write down doctor because you know it's time for a big checkup. So what do you need to then do or decide about those things? And most people kind of stop there. They say, well, I put it on a to-do list. But most to-do lists are incomplete lists of still very unclear stuff. So that's the step two, is clarify. Outcomes and actions. What is the outcome you're committed to? And what's the very next action step you need to take about mom and birthday? Is that something? Is that surf the web? Is it call your sister? Then what you need to do, stage three, is you need to organize the results of that. If you decided you need to call the bank and make an appointment, and you don't call them right then if you don't park that someplace that some part of you trust you'll see at the right time, that is when you might have time to call the bank and have a phone available, then it crawls back up in your head and becomes part of that nagging sense of, oh my God, there's stuff out there, but I forgot what it was, but I know I should be doing a whole lot of things. So the stage four is to reflect on essentially the inventory of all the stuff you've defined already. So that's where you step back and take a look at your list. And stage five is then engage. Engage meaning, okay, where do I put my attention, my resources right now? What activity do I engage in based upon all of that? So those are the five steps. That's essentially how you get stuff out of your head. But it means you have to both identify what's pulling on you. You need to clarify what it means. You need to park the things in appropriate categories, and you need to ensure that you can then look at them and engage with the stuff appropriately, so you can trust your judgments about what you do, as opposed to just be driven by whatever's latest and loudest in your head and hope it's right.
Sounds simple.
It is.
I'm joking a little bit. You know, it actually sounds, I'm kind of swimming in it. It sounds kind of overwhelming. If someone doesn't want to do that, you know, do this whole inventory and whole system, what would you say are the, I don't know, one or two best pieces of advice you have, just single pieces of advice for getting organized?
Well, get as much out of your head as you can. And, you know, the next action decision-making, like what's the very next thing I need to do about stuff? Most people wait until things blow up as opposed to when they show up to make that decision. And so front-end decision-making about what actually, if I were going to move on this thing right now, whether it's mom's birthday or extend your credit line or the doctor's appointment, what would be the very next thing I need to do? And making that kind of operational, as mundane as that sounds, but that kind of operational decision actually makes a huge difference. You know, people say, well, gee, David, how long does it take this methodology to take effect and have an effect? I say about 30 seconds. How long would it take you to write down the top 10 things that are bugging you in your head and then take, 30 seconds apiece and decide what's the very next action I need to take about each one of those? And you will feel already more in control and more focused, which are essentially the core elements of self-management. You know, and one of the things I uncovered over all these years was the two-minute rule. Once you decide the next action, if you can actually finish it in 2 minutes, you should do it right then if you're ever going to do it at all, because it'll take you longer to stack it, track it, and look at it again than it would be to actually finish it. And if that's all you get out of this, it'll give you an extra 6 months to your life. On the other hand, if you really want an empty head, which is the most optimal state to be in, that is nothing on your mind or pulling on your psyche, except wherever you point your attention, so you can pay attention to your daughter's soccer game instead of got your mind on your smartphone. And so being present, it's, you know, here's the big secret, and it's not getting things done is not really about getting things done. It's about being appropriately engaged with your life so that your life is not pulling or tugging on you and you're sitting in the driver's seat of it. And that's the optimal state to be operating from. So yes, you can implement parts of this, but if your head still has stuff that's banging around in it that you haven't kept track of and gotten on top of, you won't be able to trust either your lists or your head.
Right. So let's talk about this 2 minute rule idea, because I think this is something a lot of people get from your system. You know, say I'm a boss though, and I remember something important at 11 o'clock at night that I want to tell someone who works for me, and I know it's just going to take 2 minutes to fire off that email. Should I send the email then? A lot of people would say that, you know, the employee getting that right before bed might then get stressed out about
it. Why is the employee looking at it before they go to bed?
It's a good question, but we all do it, right?
No.
Maybe not all of us, most of us.
A lot of people do, that's right. But new brain research shows that you better not be doing email an hour and a half before you go to sleep, otherwise you're going to sub-optimize your brain's ability to knit together in the archive function of the brain. So, yes, so I understand a lot of people are there, and I understand what you're getting at, because a lot of the sort of implicit protocols, not agreed upon, but implicit or expected protocols, is everybody's supposed to be at the end of the yank of the chain if the boss decides to send an email whenever. But, you know, come on, that has a lot to do with your maturity as a professional, both the boss's as well as yours, you know, in terms of, wait a minute. And by the way, if you emptied your email out, which is a best practice, every 24 to 48 hours, people, you know, why bother looking at it that often? You know, it's like everybody's in emergency scan mode. There's no light at the end of that tunnel.
So you think people should still send, you think the manager should still send the email?
Sure. Oh, I would, sure. I'm just not expecting everybody to read it if they're asleep, you know. If they're into the end basket every 24 hours, they'll get to it.
So let's talk about the email, because that's obviously another thing that people really latch on to, and I think has almost taken on a life of its own, this concept of inbox zero. It is amazing how many people are so taken with this idea of having an empty inbox. Why do you think that has caught on so much?
Well, I think if people are catching the idea, I mean, the if you're dealing with change, the smaller your backlog of unprocessed stuff, the easier it will be. You know, that's why when I'm not doing anything else, I'm cleaning up my in-baskets to zero, because there's a surprise coming toward me I can't see. And when that unexpected thing hits, I don't want a whole bunch of unprocessed things that may have who knows what in it sitting there as a backlog, because then I can't, you know, in full consciousness, you know, assess and deal with this new thing appropriately. I'm going to feel bugged by it and bothered by it because, oh, my God, I got too much to do. Now you give me something else. Now you just interrupt it and disturb me. Because there really are no interruptions. They're only mismanaged inputs. You know, anytime you're having to reread emails to redecide whether it's something you should do something about, it's a huge waste of your cognitive energy.
Yeah. Does the increasing amount of things we own, do you think, contribute to that same feeling of being overwhelmed?
I think it can. I mean, I know And I don't know that that's necessarily a source of stress for people, although it's very easy for a lot of stuff to accumulate. You know, I used to call it Allen's Law. You'll fill up with crap every inch of space you give yourself. So, you know, if you, and the problem is, you know, everything in the center drawer of your desk actually belonged there at one time, but over time things change their meaning. So over time, a lot of that stuff just becomes not quite so important or useful to you. And if you haven't sort of rethought that stuff, I think there is at least a subtle or a subliminal kind of nagging that grows about all that.
So a lot of the book is about, and a lot of your system is about organizing things that need to get done. It's about productivity. There's also, I think, a big strain of talk about when do you do your best work? How do you get up and take breaks? What's the best time of day to be doing the right kinds of things? Do you address any of these more better time management issues?
There are people much more expert than me in that field. There are two brand new books out, The Organized Mind by Dan Levitin and the newer one, Brain Chains by Theo Compagnoli. They're both brilliant books, aggregations of a lot of the cognitive science research about that. I think it's a good idea. I mean, one of my habits I've started to install is the thing that I most hate doing, do it as early as I can, first off in the day, while I've got a good bit of fresh energy, and tackle it first so that the rest of the day becomes more of a reward. That's a good habit to get into.
Probably one of the biggest changes over the last nearly 15 years since your first book came out is just the onslaught and the omnipresence of alerts and information that we're getting. Is a system like Getting Things Done still able to manage and process all of that extraordinarily more information and messaging that we're getting?
There's always more to do than you can do, and there's always more to read than you can read. So that's always been true. So, but I understand what you're saying. It's more the ubiquity of it and the variety of it and the omnipresence of it. You know, I don't. Social media doesn't bother me. I still do some Facebook stuff and Instagram and Twitter. I just look at it as a cocktail party. You know, you wouldn't want to spend your life in a cocktail party, but it's not bad if I feel like I want to just wander in and see what's going on. That whole thing, and again, Theo Compagnoli's book on brain change talks a lot about the addictive nature of the always-on digital world now. He quotes a very fascinating study that says, even if you've just got your smartphone in your purse or your pocket, you're thinking about what might be on there creates a dopamine rush.
Mm-hmm.
So you are literally getting addicted to all of that. So that's, and you know, he makes the point, which I agree with, which is don't shoot the media, you know, about that. It's just, you need, it just makes it that much more evident. What are you not doing when you let yourself get, attracted and distracted and addicted to that stuff? You know, are you doing real thinking? Are you having real conversations with people? Are you really, you know, doing the work that you really think you need to do? There's nothing wrong with entertaining yourself or recreational, you know, surfing of the web or whatever. You know, what the heck? But, you know, be careful, you know, about what you're not doing.
Are there ways that you've learned how to turn it off, whether it's turning off all the alerts on your phone or never sleeping with your smartphone next to your bed, or just kind of
all the above? You know, again, if you clean up backlog regularly, you don't need to be always on it. If it's an emergency, people can reach me. They know how to do that. And you know, the fact that I'm getting back to people within a certain period of time, you know, means that they don't have to be constantly paying, and I don't have to constantly be seeing what's happening. Now, you know, if somebody said, "Hey, David, I'm about to, you know, sign a $1 billion contract, and I'll let you know as soon as that happens," I'm probably going to be checking email every 15 minutes. Why not? Because, you know, sure, I would want to know. I'd want to be informed for sure. But again, I wouldn't make that a habit. And yeah, the ability to, you know, just leave it all behind and walk out and just take a walk and have none of that with you. That's a great, healthy thing to do. It's hard to afford to do that, though, if you're not, pretty much implementing these techniques I was talking about.
Well, it's something to aspire to.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and stay tuned for a new conversation next week. You can also go to washingtonpost.com/leadership to watch our videos and read more stories.